And thank you very much for coming to, again, another Chamberlain lecture. We've had a wonderful time with our lectures. I'm glad to see some new faces and some familiar faces who have been coming to our lectures. My name is Penny Carson. I am the current president of the Cumberland Club. We think of the Cumberland Club as, from historically, as being the center for civic discourse, and we are in an effort to bring that back by using the club and inviting our members and friends to come to something like this evening's, I was going to say entertainment, but I'm not too sure if that was appropriate to say that. So I wanted to just take a moment to introduce everybody. Starting at my far right is AJ, for those of you who don't know, AJ Higgins from Maine Public Broadcasting Network. AJ got his journalistic start at the Bangor Daily News. You got that Bangor. You got that, didn't you? Which he joined while he was still a senior in high school. During his 34 years stint there, he rose to political editor and State House bureau chief, which happens to be his current title at MPBN. And then next to him is Mary Ellen Fitzgerald. Mary Ellen Fitzgerald is the president and founder of one of the largest and most respected nonpartisan market research and public opinion polling firms in New England. Ms. Fitzgerald has a degree in English education and psychology from Tufts University and a business administration from Johns Hopkins University. Next to Mary Ellen is Pat Callahan from WCSH Channel 6 TV. Born and raised in the Boston area, Pat has been covering politics in Maine since 1979. He has co-anchored Maine's most watched newscast since 1989, hosts the weekly political interview segment called In the Arena, and has produced documentaries on some of Maine's most significant public figures, including Ed Muskie, George Mitchell, and Bill Cohen. Oh my, I wish they were all there now. And then we have Mike Tipping from Down East Magazine and MainePolitics.net. Mike grew up in Orono and lives in Westbrook. Along with writing his lively political blogs, he works for the Maine People's Alliance and the Maine People's Resource Center. And here, closest to me on my right, is Susan Cover from the Kennebec Journal. Susan has covered state politics since moving to Maine in 2002. A native of Ohio, she's worked for newspapers in Rhode Island, Ohio, and Kansas. She has a master's degree in newspaper journalism from Syracuse University. And we thank you very much for coming. We hope that you will take note that there are cards and pencils spread out around here, so that as information or items arise in your thoughts, you could write questions that we will bring forward and then ask the panel. But I'm going to start right off to get the ball rolling a little bit to see if we can get some civic discourse moving. To the entire panel, which I will then just change order periodically, who will win the gubernatorial election in Maine and why? And I'll just go from right to left at this point, from AJ.
Well,
good one, Peter.
You know, we'd all like to know the answer to that question. And in this particular election cycle, we saw one in which I think that it's fair to say that voters from the day after the primary were not particularly caught up in this thing. And I really kind of am getting the feeling at this moment that we're sort of looking at a funnel-like effect on the campaign season, that people are finally starting to get involved and are sort of rotating around to where they want to go. And I don't know if I could actually predict who the winner is going to be, but recent polls have showed that that Paul LePage is not necessarily where he was, say, right after the primaries. But it seems to be, you know, very tight. You know, I just can't really predict who it would be at this point. I think it's anybody's guess. I've said from the beginning, I think, that it's really about who's going to make mistakes from here on out. What we have seen that's kind of interesting lately is that the Republican candidate has been disengaging from a lot of candidate debates, citing scheduling conflicts. And
threatening to punch you.
Well, that happens. That happens.
Who hasn't?
Yeah, that's true. He has to get in line for that one. But I think that it's a question at this point of who doesn't really, you know, make a serious error in judgment. And we saw, I think, a little bit of a setback for Libby Mitchell earlier this week with this business about the picture with President Bush, which, you know, I've talked to some of her people. She says, you know, someone just basically put that that picture in her hands at a fundraiser, and somebody just grabbed her picture, and she was doing it for jokes, but who knows? But I guess I would say it could be anybody's guess at this point.
Yeah, it's very volatile. I mean, I think it's kind of unusual for a pollster not to at least give you some sense of direction. We just released a poll today that shows that Mitchell and LePage are really in a statistical dead heat when you count in lean voters and Elliot Cutler's coming in at about, or leaning voters, and when you count in Elliot Cutler, who's coming in at about 13%. It's anybody's guess. I have to say, Penny, I grew up in Massachusetts where politics is a blood sport, you know, that you learn at birth, as did you, Pat. But this particular election season has taken the cake. This is really different than almost anything that I've seen. And to a certain extent, it's, you know, there's you couldn't have two more diametrically opposed party candidates. You know, Libby Mitchell is the quintessential Democrat candidate, and Paula Page is the quintessential Republican candidate. And, you know, they're neither one of them at this point, 3 weeks from the election, has really been able to capture a plurality of the voting public's commitment, although, again, it changes on a daily basis. We still have 18% of our likely voters. These are not of all voters. These are voters who have demonstrated and articulated a commitment to vote, who have not decided how they're going to vote. So that's a fairly big number. That's one in every five. And when you see that kind of volatility and indecision in an environment where you have things like that are certainly making the press coverage lively, I think it is anybody's guess.
Well, I think we'll come back to, we'll have an opportunity to come back because Mary Ellen's company has just completed a new poll, which most people don't know about. So, Pat.
I'd have to agree with Mary Ellen. I think this may be the most interesting race for governor that I've seen probably since 1990 when it was Jock McKernan against Joe Brennan. You essentially had two incumbents going at it, and that was really that was high stakes, heavyweight stuff. And it was the closest thing toward the end that we ever got to what some might consider an ugly campaign, and it really wasn't. It just by Maine standards, it seemed like it at the time. This certainly, most reporters are really looking for a good story, and this campaign gives it to you. Paul LePage is the gift that keeps on giving, and Libby Mitchell. Well, it's true, and Libby Mitchell is doing her part as well. I'm not really in the business of making predictions, but I do have a feeling just from looking at these numbers. If you accept that they're in a dead heat right now, with 18 to some polls say as much as 26% still undecided, I have a hard time envisioning LePage getting the lion's share of those undecideds if they haven't already made the choice for him. It's harder to see them going his way than it is to see them going to Cutler or Libby Mitchell. So you end up with this almost three-way split. It could be a long, long night by the time the ballots are cast and counted. I just think we're really going to see this being close. And I've also had the sense ever since the primary that Libby Mitchell is glad to have Sean Moody and even Kevin Scott in the race in hopes of bleeding something off from Elliot Cutler. It's why she made such a big deal out of not wanting to attend forums that they weren't invited to. You're only talking at this point by 5 or 6 points, but that's more than enough to make a difference in a three-way race. So that's not a prediction, but it's just a feeling that I would never want to have to bet real money on who's going to win this thing.
Well, I like to know that it's not set yet.
Yeah.
Mike.
I guess, first of all, I should do a little bit of disclosure. First of all, I'm a low talker, so if I'm not projecting enough, do let me know. Second, an organization I work for, the Maine People's Alliance, is affiliated with a PAC, MPA campaign vote that has endorsed Libby Mitchell. And I also was the 5,000th fan of Martin's on Facebook. And I received a $50 gift certificate. And that company, of course, employs Mr. Paul LePage. So I have to disagree a little bit with Pat. I think where we are right now and the kind of things that we've seen over time and the kind of turnout I think we're going to see in this election and the kind of issues it's being waged over, I think you have to think that Paul LePage has a bit of an advantage. And as much as we like to talk about the interesting things that happen during campaigns and everything that the media loves about campaigns, a lot of this was decided a little while ago. And candidates at this point, it's difficult for them to win, but it's a lot easier for them to lose. LePage has been trying very hard to do that, but I'm not sure he's there yet. So I'd say he may have a little bit of an advantage, especially if we see the kind of grassroots effort from him we've seen, in, obviously, in the primary.
And as far as who's going to win, of course, I wouldn't dare guess at this point either, like nobody else on the panel.
I need reminders.
Is that a reminder that says to be here at 6 o'clock?
In addition to the undecided voters that we've all talked about, I think one thing to bear in mind is that Libby Mitchell's numbers really haven't moved off 30% from July until now. And I think there's a lot of, we can speculate a lot about why that is, and whether she's going to actually pick up some momentum with just, what, almost 2.5 weeks to go now, not even 3 weeks anymore. So I think that's something, you know, to take a look at, to consider. Are these undecideds just unhappy with everybody and they just are waiting for someone to stumble or someone to shine? I mean, I think she did have a bit of a stumble on Monday. I think going back to even February, that's the first time I've seen her really have any sort of gaffe. I mean, she's run a very disciplined and a campaign, but it doesn't seem to have helped her. So
she also answered it quickly, which LePage never did. And I think she's getting better advice on that sort of thing, which tends to minimize the damage from it.
Or taking the advice.
Well, yes. Right.
Thank you. I'm going to direct some questions to individual members on the panel, and if anyone wants to weigh in on that question, I can move down the list here to questions for each of you, but if you'd like to weigh in on any questions that's asked to an individual. So, Mary Ellen, how influential a role did the Tea Party play in the main election, the primaries and the...
You know, that's a really interesting question, because I think there's been a lot of different efforts to pinhole and position the Tea Party. But there was recently a poll that was released in the Wall Street Journal. We didn't do it, by the way. But it was a poll that was released in the Wall Street Journal that surveyed Republicans, and 73% of Republicans identified on some level with some of the basic Tea Party tenets.
What was the percent?
73%. So I think what you have is you have a movement that has been identified with a certain conservative element, but they're talking about fiscal responsibility, and they're talking about the kinds of things that voters are focused on. So I do think that they've certainly raised the level of awareness, raised the level of discourse. The role that they had, your question was the role in the primary, and I think that they were able to really mobilize their members pretty efficiently and significantly in a relatively cost-effective way. And I think that's why we have Paula Page as a gubernatorial candidate. So they were pretty effective. But I do think it's a mistake to talk about the Tea Party as if they are just a minute faction of the electorate, because I think that they have crossed over. Some of their ideas and platform positions have really crossed over to mainstream.
Do you think it's going to have the effect that it had in the primary? Do you think it's going to have the same effect or a different effect in this election in 2 weeks?
I think
falling off by the wayside, or are they getting stronger? Or?
Well, I think they're a force to be reckoned with. I do think you know, when you ask people, when you stop people on the street or you ask them in an unaided environment what kinds of things they associate with the Tea Party, the kinds of things that they're articulating back are things like fiscal responsibility, accountability, the kinds of things that the electorate is talking about. So I think that they are going to be a factor.
And they're organized, and
they are the only voter group that a candidate has attempted to try and ingratiate himself to, and that's Paul LePage. He has actively attempted to seek out the support of the Tea Party.
Excuse me, we just want to get this a little lower. So,
well, I think, AJ, that's right. They're probably the most motivated voters as well, and that's really what it comes down to, who actually bothers to vote.
Anybody else want to weigh in on the Tea Party question?
Well, I think you're right about their motivation and possibly about turnout. I think perhaps the public perception of the Tea Party has also changed a little bit over time. Originally, they were seen as more extreme, and now if you look at those kind of national polls, they're seen as being simply another example of the Republican Party in general. I mean, they've seemed to have kind of taken the place or being the same thing as that kind of the conservative side of our politics.
But I do have to wonder if the voters who voted in June as part of the primary, if there's a lot more of them out there to propel someone like LePage to a win versus that was it for the primary and the Tea Party, and whether that's going to reach beyond, I don't know.
Well,
I think the quick answer to that, and this is all speculation, but I think the quick answer to that is if there are a lot more of them out there, they haven't moved. I mean, you know, we were talking about Libby not moving too much in the last couple of months. Well, we haven't seen a lot of movement with LePage either. I mean, it's been, you know, 5-6 points, but it hasn't been the sprint that you or the sprint that I think he would have hoped if the Tea Party, you know, were overextended.
I think this begs the question, too, what becomes of Maine's moderate Republicans, the ones who have tended to elect all of the Republican leaders that we've seen in the last 30, 40 years? And I had to admit, I was surprised after the primary. I would have thought Cutler would rise faster than he did, because those who supported Steve Abbott or Peter Mills, you know, that they would not be satisfied with LePage as their candidate. They certainly wouldn't go to Libby Mitchell, so where do they go? Theoretically, Cutler. That's what he was counting on. We really haven't seen that happen yet, and if it's going to, it's got to happen now.
Mm-hmm. And that's because some of the moderate Republicans that I have talked to continue to perceive Cutler as a Democrat who has run as an independent for the sake of convenience.
So where do they go?
Not to Cutler. And they've got a lot of pressure on them to support the Republican candidate. I spoke to members of Senator Collins' staff this week, and I can tell you that there's a lot, perhaps, that they disagree with LePage on, but they're going to stand with him. And Senator Snow is also feeling that pressure. She's up for reelection in a couple of years, and she needs to be on board.
And she has a personal friendship with LePage through her family connections as well, which doesn't hurt. You know,
right.
People vote for worse reasons than that.
And I just had a quick question while we have an expert on polling here. Do you think that there is a greater proportion of Tea Party members that are hesitant to answer, that refuse in media polls? I mean, it seems to be part of their lexicon to be against the mainstream media and that kind of thing. I mean, do you think we're accurately getting the numbers?
I do. Your question is basically, is there a disproportionate representation in that 18% don't know of Tea Party members? I have no way of knowing that. My sense is, however, that going into this election where things are so tight, if Tea Party members were strongly supportive of Paul LePage, that they would want the poll numbers to reflect that. So I don't think that they're disproportionately represented.
Thank you. Susan, some polls have showed that many women are turned off by Paul LePage's campaign rhetoric. Do you agree or disagree with that, that the female vote is weighing or not weighing whether to vote for LePage, even the female moderate Republican women?
I think we have seen in the polls that Mary Ellen has done a movement of women away from LePage and toward Mitchell. And I don't know, I think it is partly his style, part of it is what he's saying. But again, we don't see her jumping up by huge numbers because people are voting for her because she's a woman. She does tend to have some beliefs, that, of course, more liberal women would hold. But it's not to say, though, that I'm sure conservative Republican women will stick with LePage. They don't really have any other viable choice on the ballot.
Mary Ellen might have some.
We keep talking about this poll that we just released. There's a poll that we've been doing. There are four different waves of this poll in conjunction with Maine Today, the Portland Press Herald, and their associated newspapers. And so that's the poll that we're talking about. We just released one today. It's on the website. And one of the things that since it's public information, 42% of males are supporting Paul LePage. So he has he has significantly more support among males, is the better way to say it, than does Libby. So he has a strong male orientation in his support. Women tend to be more likely to support Mitchell.
Okay. Pat. Of the three independent candidates, Elliot Cutler clearly has been making best showing in the verbally and making this presentation. Do you think he's really positioning himself for a run for the U.S. Senate for 2012?
Well, that may be in the back of his mind as a fallback plan. I have no reason to think he doesn't believe he's going to win this election or mm-hmm. do everything he can to win, to be the governor. So I think he's, without knowing what's inside his brain, I would think he is focused on this race, and this is the prize that he's after. And it's interesting to see, as I mentioned, I was a little surprised that his numbers didn't rise more quickly. And it's hard to tell exactly what it is that some voters, they don't connect with him. He obviously can't be Angus King. You know, he thinks, well, Maine elects independents before. He's not Angus King. He doesn't share the electoral skills, if you will, that Angus brought to the table, though the dissatisfaction with the parties is always there. My sense is the people are somehow turned off by his manner. Even some of his friends have been quoted as saying he's not affable, but, you know, we know he can get the job done. And if I were selling him, I think I'd try to find a way to make that a virtue. If you can't be the lovable one, if you can't be Angus King, then you have to be the guy who says, yeah, maybe I'm a little gruff, but you know what? I know how to fix this, and I'm going to do it if you put me in that office. I think he has to go for that competence angle as opposed to, you know, feel good about me. And that may be what, who knows, the kind of thing that they were looking for.
Well, I think we've seen some of that. There's been a change in positioning in his campaign. I noticed in some of the campaign literature and advertising in the newspapers, tagline has changed recently.
Yep.
The picture has changed. I think that's what he's going for is the competence position.
It has certainly taken a while, but yeah, he does seem to be turning in that direction.
Yeah. So, Mary Ellen, in this just poll that you've just completed that's just been released by the newspaper, is that Cutler has gone up a little bit?
He's at about 13%.
He's showing a little shift.
We're seeing some momentum. I mean, it's clearly some momentum in his, you know, it's certainly not a number that he wants, but.
No. Well, thank you. AJ, I have to ask this. Earlier this month, LePage told an interviewer he wanted to punch you out. Why was he so angry at you specifically? Is there anyone else on his hit list?
Well. Probably, but I don't know who they are. He's only mentioned me, but that was sort of the culmination of kind of like a bad day for Paul. Paul had a really bad day the day he said that. He was also having a bad day 2 weeks earlier when this business was going on about his wife and the real estate in Florida, and we'd heard so many different stories about why his name was on the deed or was it not on the deed, but it's not on the deed, but it's on the mortgage, or, you know, it got very confusing, and so all we were looking for was a little clarity on this, and so so Paul decided on this particular day that he was going to hold a statewide series of news conferences on his economic plan, which the details of which we were frequently referred back to his website. Just keep going to the website. So, but anyway, we went along with that, you know, and we said, okay, we'll go to these things. And we had a reporter in Bangor, and we had a reporter in Augusta, and we also had a reporter in Portland where all three of these news conferences were being held. So on the first leg of the press conferences was in Bangor, and our reporter asked him at that time about the deeds in Florida. What's the story with the deeds? And is your name on it or isn't it? And what, you know, why was your wife a resident of Florida? And, you know, sort of just trying to get down to some gut issues here and find some answers. And he basically dismissed her question. And, you know, she was, you know, a young reporter and basically said, okay. And that was that, okay. So then he decided he was going to call a press conference an hour block down at the State House, which in the press corps halls, where this is where we live, okay? We sleep there, too, sometimes. I mean, when the legislature goes all night, we're there, you know? So he wanted to call a press conference there, and he did his economic plan, and we listened to that for about 30 minutes and asked a lot of questions and did our thing. And then at the end of that, you know, he entertained some other questions, and of course, you know, I asked about the deed. And at which point his guy that was there, which was sort of with him on the campaign, said that was the end of the questions, you know. And you know, which is okay if you're a governor. If you're a governor and we're in the governor's office and the governor's guy says, we'll take one more question, that's all right. You know, we'll honor that. But, you know, he was in our place. Summoning us to his press conference, and, you know, the rules of engagement are a little different there. So, you know, I then proceeded to ask him about this, and, you know, he basically said, well, you know, I've already answered that question. And, you know, if he hadn't answered it to me, you know, I don't know who he gave the answer to, but, you know, I really didn't know what the answer was. And so I sort of pursued it with him. And he started to leave, and I continued to pursue it with him as he was leaving, at which point he sort of wheeled around and went on to tell me that his name was never on the deed to the property that he and his wife owned in Augusta, which I knew was not true because I had the deed in my hand and his name was on the deed. And he later took his name off the deed, and we were still trying to kind of get to that. I've never actually gotten the answer. I don't know why he took his name off the deed. Now, there are any number of theories out there as to why he may have done that, but, you know, I still haven't gotten an answer to that. But that's what sort of got him riled. And then from there, he went to Portland, and Josie Wong, who is a very intimidating reporter, I must tell you, okay, then asked him the same question at the press conference in Portland, and that was where the BS remark came out at that point. He just, at that point, LePage just said, you know, this is total BS, and that was sort of the end. But at that point, also, he did actually kind of elaborate a little bit and provide some answers. But I think that, you know, I think, to answer your question, I think he kind of holds me responsible for that. And, you know, the impression I got from him is that, you know, I guess he thought that that he wasn't going to have to answer any questions like this. But, you know, when you run for governor, basically everything is on the table, and you have to be willing to discuss it. Now, you know something? Had he told me at that time that simply that, you know what, this is a private matter, it's my family that's involved, and I'm just not going to answer any questions on this topic, I probably wouldn't have said a word. But that's not what he told me. He told me he'd already answered it, and he wasn't going to tell us what his answer was. So that's how that all came about. And as to whether or not there are other people on his hit list, I don't know.
He said he didn't want to talk to Susan Sharon either, just in fairness.
Right? Oh, that's right, yeah. That's my boss.
He doesn't like all of you, huh?
Of course, that's the famous exchange at the State House that's now in Libby Mitchell's ads. For those, it's hard to miss.
Yeah.
If you didn't see it when it originally happened, you're seeing it all the time on these spots. Mm-hmm. And I think the question is, how important is that going to be to voters? I think if you're already solidly in his corner, it doesn't matter. It's just good for you taking on the media like that. But others may say, gee, I don't know, is this the kind of, does he have a cool head in a crisis that maybe we want? And so those are the ones it might damage.
I think your observation is right on point. It's the marginal voters, the voters who have soft support that are going to be impacted by that, and maybe the voters who are undecided. But 76% of his supporters are strong, solid, absolutely, we are not changing, deliberate supporters. And I don't think that's going to have an impact on them.
Well, given just as a sort of a follow-up on that, and maybe Mike and Sue will have a chance to also weigh in on this, that this is not my forte, but as I understand it, that there is a code of ethics for journalism to, this a bottom line for journalists to stay through. And I wondered how that affects somebody like Mike who does blogs and all the other people that do blogs, and also especially about what has been going on with the blog against Cutler and what they're finding out about that. I mean, Mike may have a response about that. As I think about it, I think about the fact that we in the public who are not in journalism or are not politicians or anything, we like to think that there's some level of fact and truth coming out. And we like to think that somebody's station or somebody's newspaper has a bottom line that they say, you get some facts, get the background, and I'll print it if we can prove it. But there isn't any of that, not just Mike's blog, but, I mean, any kind of blogging. They may or may not find out any facts or not. That may be the thing. But I'm particularly concerned, as I say outright, as a Democrat supporting Cutler, that I'm concerned about the blog about Cutler and where that information comes from and how to deal with that. So, Mike, you might be able to respond to that.
Sure. And I should say that I am now actually writing a bit in print. I'm doing a weekly column for the Kennebec Journal and the Morning Sentinel. So I have to clean up my act. but I don't know. I think it's been a bit different writing for Down East, where there are editors and they do, check on that kind of stuff, at least to some degree. But yeah, I mean, obviously the internet is a wide open place in terms of what goes for political campaigns and for citizen journalism. And we've seen a lot of that, and we've seen a lot of the things that have made news in this campaign come from the internet, the most recent being the Facebook photo of Libby Mitchell. on the Cutler files specifically, the website that Elliot Cutler has filed a complaint with the Maine Ethics Commission on, I think that was a real tactical mistake on behalf of the Cutler campaign. I think very few people would have seen that website, and they would have been people that were already looking for political information online, already involved in the campaigns, probably knew who they were going to vote for. And instead, his complaint against it resulted in a series of media articles, I think by most of the people up here, about it and getting the URL out there and letting people know more about that information. I think it was probably a mistake from his campaign to spread that further, especially because at this point they haven't discovered who it was. I mean, if it comes out that the blog, that the website was done by his political opponents, obviously that's something that will take away from its credibility and perhaps make him look like a victim or make him look better. But at this point, I think it's only hurt his campaign.
I'm interested in the if it was by the political opponents. Couldn't be from his friends. So it must be.
Be
from his. Political
I should say,
opponents,
yeah, his political opponents affiliated with a different campaign.
Yeah, right. Okay. Does anybody else want to comment on this ethics and blogging?
When it comes to blogging and the internet, it's reader beware. You don't know where you're going to land when you Google something, and I think it's everyone's responsibility. A little bit unfortunately, to figure out what you're reading and where the sources are. I mean, we have very different standards as part of the mainstream media, which is a term that's not exactly nicely used all the time, but we do have standards. And there are things that we read on blogs that if I can't prove it, if I can't get the sources that I need to back it up, I can't print it. And as much as my bosses yell at me and say, how could this blogger have this and you don't have it? Well, I can't go there, and I won't. And so we do have a certain responsibility, as newspapers and even our websites are an extension of what we do in print, to make sure that what we're doing is accurate and has been vetted, which is very different from a lot of the stuff you might stumble across on the internet.
Although, I mean, it should be noted that newspapers, the comments section, are where a lot of the worst attacks and the worst kind of the worst you'll see of the internet takes place. And they are moderated usually to some degree, but you'll often see those kind of unsourced things in a place that a lot of people will see them.
Yeah, I mean, in general, and when it comes to ethics, I think people come to us, the old media, because they trust we're going to treat people fairly and we're going to get the facts right. And if we don't, then we do corrections or clarifications. And it happens, thankfully, not that often. But the candidates know if we get something wrong, they bring it to our attention and we'll make it right. Even if you don't especially enjoy doing that, but it happens.
If I didn't have Snopes or whatever the rest of them were, you know, when I get these tons and tons of emails, I'm going, oh my gosh, wow, they're going to be dropping a bomb. And, you know, I go there and you find out that they're always false. But I have friends who've never heard of the places which you go to see if it's true or false. Right, because these urban myths, as they call them. And so I was concerned about the Cutler files when they first came out.
I have a question for Mike. Okay, and I like Mike. But, you know, I have to ask you, okay?
That's not a good
story. No. You're a player. You're a player in politics. You work for the Maine People's Alliance. They're funded by union dues. They follow Democratic ideology. How do you balance your opinions against the people that pay you?
Right. Well, I think the big thing about that is making sure that it's disclosed. So there's obviously a disclaimer on my blog. It's on everything I write. And also, I mean, there are obviously those distinctions even with, as Susan said, the mainstream media, where there's an opinion page where you have voices from the community, columnists that do obviously work in politics often and take stances on that, other writers for the Kennebec Journal that I now do some writing for include George Smith, obviously, who was recently working for SAM, for Tony Payne, for the Alliance for Maine's Future. I mean, those kind of political voices have always been a part of journalism. I just think it's important that those connections are disclosed and people know that it's opinion and where it's coming from.
Just as a disclosure, I don't even know what a blog is or how to get to it, but I thought I'd ask the question.
You know, that's a really interesting observation,
Penny. I don't know how to get to a blog.
Because you have to look at the distribution of voters across the state and the age distribution, and to a certain extent, you know, blogging is a younger function. And if you read these blogs, people are very energized, and you're right, they're not always polite, and there's something that comes with anonymity. You know, it's if you sign your name to something, you're going to make sure that it's something you're proud of. But if you can just write anything under an alias, it makes it different. I'm talking about the responders, not the bloggers, although there's an element of that too. But I think one of the things that happens is we really need to look at the impact that these blogs have and who they're impacting, because most people, you know, mainstream voters, 45 and up, not spending a lot of time looking at blogs. It's more of a younger cohort that really is actively involved in reading the blogs and paying attention to them, and you know, and bringing issues up. So it really does create a chasm in terms of impact. As the population ages, you know, one of the things that a lot of these candidates and all the campaigns are finding is that they have to appeal to voters across a modality of different media, because not everybody is going to respond to the internet, not everybody's going to respond to the newspaper. But the reality is, in a state like this, most people 45 up read the newspaper every day. Now, some of us are really cool and do it online, but we read the newspaper every day. You know, we know which button to push. And that's not so much the way that younger people get information or make decisions. So there really is a great divide. And the real, I think, question comes from, it's really two-pronged. One, what percentage of the voting population actually pays attention and participates in these blogs? And secondly, what percentage of the population that's actively involved in these blogs goes out to vote? Because if it's a younger cohort, the younger cohort really doesn't vote in the same numbers that the older cohort does. It's interesting.
Yeah. Good. Thanks. I do have some other questions here. And even off the gubernatorial, I was going to do some other questions. But I think there's so many people that have asked questions from the audience that I think it would be important to get to some of those. So I'm going to start right out. Who has the most effective platform to address the state's fiscal problems? So let me start at this end this time. Susan, I know you're on the spot because we just asked the question. But however they presented their platform.
Well, I think from traveling around and going to a lot of the forums and debates where all the candidates have appeared, I think L.A. Cutler has given the most specifics about what he would do if elected governor. And those include economic issues and things with schools and other areas, and transportation in particular he talked about today with municipal officials. So I think, to me, that's effective as a journalist because you get more specifics and more information. Now, depending on your point of view and who you might want to support, obviously you might be interested in other things or different approaches to what the problems that he's trying to solve.
Well, I guess I'm not entirely familiar with Kevin Scott's policy formula. I haven't heard too much about that. But of the candidates I know, I can say it's definitely not Paul LePage. And I can't believe there hasn't been more talk about his proposals in terms of tax cuts. Just the sheer numbers. I know Elliot Cutler did release a graph on that and a release and tried to make some news around it. Just what those numbers would mean for the state, because I don't think a lot of people understand exactly what those would be.
Sounds good, though, right?
No, I think everybody's terribly vague except for Cutler. Again, he has put out detailed proposals, and I think that's smart in his case if he is trying to sell himself as a fixer. And he's even gone as far as to say specifically he'd like to put Dave Flanagan, the former head of CMP, in charge of Health and Human Services. Well, there are a lot of people who insiders at least, who follow these things, who know, well, he's a smart guy. Maybe that does make sense. It's a good thing to put out there so people can actually judge and say, well, all right, yeah, that could work, and maybe that's why I should support him. Where the rest of them, LePage, Mitchell, I just find them shockingly vague. And it doesn't matter how many times you ask them, tell me something you're going to cut because you have to cut something. Who are you going to say no to? And they don't ever want to alienate anybody. They just they'll find a way to slither around it. So,
you know, we don't usually have consensus with a panel like this, but I'm gonna jump on that bandwagon too. I do have to say that, I mean, each of the candidates has a strong sort of general approach to fiscal responsibility and to mentioning things, but when it comes to very specific programs, it's really hard to see what they're going to cut and what they're going to maintain and support, with the exception of Elliot Cutler, who, you know, arguably has nothing to lose because he doesn't have mainstream support from either of the parties. I noticed he had taken on the teachers union, which is really a significant and powerful voting bloc in this state, by taking some very, very strident positions about the quality of education and educational funding in the state. That's the kind of, and I'm saying this in a nonpartisan way, even though there was a comment that I was a Cutler supporter, I'm not. There was a retraction about that. But I do have to say that that's the kind of sort of cutting-edge thinking that the state needs, and I think that when you see that, what you see is that explains why so many people are undecided, because people are really looking at the two mainstream candidates and saying, you know, the economy and jobs, that's number one. That's all anybody's thinking about. That's all anybody's talking about. People vote their pocketbook. They vote their economic interest. And that's really what people are the most concerned about. And then they look at the two mainstream candidates, and they're not getting a lot of meat. They're not getting this, and this. And then you have the independent candidate who doesn't necessarily have the support of the traditional forces within the party that can bandy voters to the polls for him, and he's taking those positions. So I think that's my answer.
Early on, I was very impressed with Elliot Cutler's presentation with respect to energy, and that is directly related to our economy here in Maine. The availability of affordable energy has eluded us, yet we produce more electricity in this state than we consume. It seems absurd. We have natural gas lines that run by people's homes, and nobody ever taps in, but it's on its way down to the markets down in southern New England. Yeah, and Cutler has made it very clear that Nepal may not be in Maine's future, that perhaps we don't need that to be on the grid, and perhaps we could make better arrangements dealing with New Brunswick or Hydro-Quebec. He's not particularly concerned about the impact that it might have on wind generation. I mean, so often we've heard now that, we really don't want to try and cut into too many deals with Canada because, you know, we could cut our own throats as far as wind production turbines are concerned. And, I think Elliot wants a good deal for Maine and wants it as soon as possible. And I think, you know, that cheaper energy is his main goal, and probably would be the greatest positive improvement to our economy if we can possibly achieve that.
This is really interesting because you obviously all, when you go into the polls, you all vote whatever way you personally vote. But when you think of what the polls are saying about these three candidates, and if the issue is he making himself clear, or her, making herself clear? What is the platform? What will they do? And all we get is sound bites. And here you are saying, gee, as you went along the line, each time the question was thought about the platform, it was stated, it was clear, it wasn't a sound bite. And yet, this is not the way the people are seeing it out there. Is that there's enough people that just don't only think in one way and not weighing the issues? But it's interesting that you all felt the same way about the platform information given by the candidates. Okay. Mary Ellen, this is directed to you. It says, today's Rasmussen poll reached a different result. Comment, please.
Absolutely. I'm happy to. I get that all the time. Rasmussen did a sample of 500 and came up with similar numbers in the LePage and Mitchell position, saw them in a dead heat, saw Elliot Cutler breaking 21%, I think, and we had him at 13%. So that is a significant. They also had a much lower undecided cohort than we did. We had about 18% undecided in our poll. Different methodologies. So you know, not to say one is better or one is worse. The Rasmussen poll is a telephone poll where respondents key in their responses to a recorded voice. Ours is a live telephone. It's the same people, you know, interrupting you at dinner. It's just whether or not you answer them directly or you key in your response. That said, I have some questions, and there have been some sort of methodological concerns voiced about those kinds of keyed-in responses because you're never really sure who you're speaking to. When you have a live interviewer on the phone, you ask to speak with the youngest registered voter in the household because we know that voters skew older. You ask for the younger one to make sure that we have a representation of younger voters, and then when that person comes on the phone, you again go through the screener to make sure that they're qualified to participate, that they are likely voters, that they intend to vote in the next election. There's a whole series of pre-qualifiers. Don't necessarily get that when you have somebody on the phone. So the criticism oftentimes for polls like that is that you get the seventh grader or the eighth grader who's like, oh, yeah, this is who I like. I'm going to do this. It's a possibility. So I think that there's different methodologies to that approach. And Rasmussen, you know, he's been polling for a very long time, longer than I've been polling, but we approach the questions differently.
Marielle, what about the fact that he didn't name all of the independent candidates?
I feel strongly that if people are on the ballot, they should be named. And I think you said, as we've all noticed, you know, Moody and Scott capture about 5 or 6% of the voting population. That's really where they're coming in. But that's 5 or 6% of people who have chosen to exercise their right to vote in support of a particular candidate, and you have to be able to recognize that, and that's a valid approach. So if those candidates aren't mentioned, I don't know where they go in the Rasmussen poll.
I think they did say in that one others. You know, they had like a catch-all. I think it was about 6%.
But putting somebody in another category without articulating their name, okay, I think doesn't give them a lot of credibility.
I'm interested in knowing, I guess, over the long term, as we get closer and closer to Election Day, if Cutler shows that he's demonstrated momentum, do people leave Moody, do people leave Scott and say, you know, I don't care for either one of the two major party candidates, but I'm going to go with the independent that I think that can win?
I mean, I think the reality is that this is an election where every single vote counts. When you've got even just a strong three-way election, somebody can win with 35%. So you don't need to get to that 50% mark, and I think 5 or 6 percentage points can make a difference. I do think that some of that may happen, but I think that has to be reflected by the voters' own intent, not by a pollster who decides that somebody's not a legitimate candidate.
Well, given the fact that you said Rasmussen was using the telephone poll, what role does the cell phone or lack of cell phone play in that?
I get this question all the time, and it's a great question. Let me just, I won't bore you because I know it's dinner time. I won't be too detailed, but it is a very good question, and it's a challenge that faces my industry and anybody who does survey research. And there have been a number of different approaches. The Pew Research Center, Pew is sort of one of the large, overarching sort of guardians of the methodology in our business. And Pew really undertook a 2-year study where they looked at responses to a couple of different approaches, to really identify whether there were differences, significant differences in representation based on whether someone was a landline respondent or a cell phone only. But it's not quite that simple. It's not just cell phone or landline. It's actually 4 different categories. You have landline only. You have landline with a cell but primarily landline users. You have landline with a cell but primarily cell phone users. And then you have cell phone only. So you've got 4 different cohorts. And within those 4, the one that people are most concerned about legitimately is the presence of people who aren't accessible in any way on a landline. And that's the dilemma that confronts pollsters. The most recent data for Maine state, and it's very hard to get because the PUC doesn't have this data for some reason, but the National Health Science Survey does, shows that overall 13.4% of all Maine households are landline only, and that translates to 12% of all adults. When you look at that demographically, nationally, not just in Maine, nationally, what that means is people who are landline tend to be disproportionately, they skew Democratic, they skew lower income rather than, as you might expect, upper income, and tend to be more reflective of minorities, Hispanics and African Americans. Now, obviously, in Maine, there's not a huge Hispanic or African American population. But what we do find here is that and I'm going to go back to what I said about the Pew research. Pew analyzed all of these responses by those categories that I've mentioned, and one of the things that they found that was the most overarching is that if you only conduct research talking to landline people, and you may skew just a slight skew away. People who are cell phone only users tend to be more likely to be Democrats. So there's a slight skew that would underrepresent Democrats in that population. But mostly in Maine, the feeling is that is still within the margin of error. So you know, my sense is it's possible and it's expensive to sample people who are cell phone only, and you call them on their cell phones. And we've done a number of these surveys for some of our larger candidates, but it really triples or quadruples the cost of a survey effort. And so most clients want to sort of stay away from that if they have to. But what you do is if you can buy a sample that is cell phone only, and then you have to, when you get a cell phone user, you have to make sure that they don't have a landline in any way, because if they have a landline, they have an opportunity to be selected in the other category. So 3 out of 4 of your cell phone users are going to not be able to participate anyway, just based on that distribution. So that's a really long and boring answer, and I promised that I wouldn't do that. But the reality is, it is a factor. I think it does tend to slightly underrepresent Democrats in Maine. I don't think it's a huge issue in this statewide election now, but I think in the future going forward, it's going to become more of an issue.
Thank you. I'm going to try and move so that the audience has an opportunity to hear, hopefully, their question being asked. This is kind of an interesting one. As an old campaign worker and sign person myself, I wanted to know, since we have both parties represented, the Democrats and the Republican, why is it that the signs, the street signs, the lawn signs, do not signify whether the person is a Republican or a Democrat when they put up
that's
Dick
easy.
Smith, State Senate?
That's easy, because there's so many unenrolled voters in Maine.
Yeah.
You don't want to be locked into one or the other. You just want them to like you, regardless of affiliation.
It's not just the signs either. If you come home and find their material in your doorway, there's no party affiliation there. There's no, it doesn't, you know, they're just not doing this.
And what we found is that over the years, there's a lessening of the perceived salience of political parties, so that more and more people feel that neither party represents their interests, and so that's the kind of response that you get.
Right, and the only place you still see that is in districts where it's very much one party or the other, and
right.
It's still an advantage to put it on the sign.
This is sort of an interesting question. To the Maine-born and the not Maine-born people, what is the important political fact about the state of Maine? Is there a political fact that stands out in your mind about the state of Maine?
Yeah, I have one. I'm not Maine-born. I talk too fast. The one thing that struck me when I started polling here was the strong civil libertarian bent in Maine. There is a sense of independence and sort of a civil libertarian perspective that you find runs throughout the state that makes it really difficult to pinpoint people by party ideology. And I think we see that in a lot of different manifestations. We see it now, because in more and more elections we always have an independent. When you look at the registration distribution of voters through the Secretary of State's office, the single largest cohort right now is unenrolled, independent. I think you see it played out in public health initiatives. People who feel strongly that maybe tobacco may bother me, but it's my right, it's a legal product. I mean, those kinds of things. I think you see that expressed more vehemently here than I see in other states where we work.
I think jumping off from that too, though, is the idea that Maine voters, Maine people in general, expect a clean campaign, and they don't like a lot of personal stuff in it. Now, that may be changing. You know, we all know people say they don't like negative ads, but studies show they work. But, you know, you really don't see a lot of that here, and you don't see a lot of probing into people's personal lives unless it somehow really truly affects the campaign. So I think they've always had that expectation that you take care of the issues but leave the personal stuff out.
Well, along those lines, I was shocked by the lack of corruption here, which is a good thing. But coming from well, that's true. Yeah, it is as a citizen, but not as a reporter where you're bored. But you're coming from Ohio and seeing some of the scandals that we've had there and other parts in the country that I've lived in, it can be kind of boring at times here in Maine, because I think there's some laws in place that have prohibited the level of corruption we've seen with financing and that sort of thing. But I think it's, you know, for the most part, a pretty clean state politically.
I'd say definitely the regionalism in Maine politics, and especially some of the cultural identity, especially in northern Maine. And I don't mean Bangor and Holton. I mean, if you go to the St. John Valley, the vast majority of people are pro-gun. They're pro-life, and yet they vote overwhelmingly Democratic. And you don't see that almost anywhere else in the country. And I don't know if this is still the case, but it used to be in the St. John Valley, in towns like Madawaska, they had single-party voting of 90%, which is higher than anywhere else in the country outside of inner-city black populations. I mean, it's kind of fascinating, the different parts of Maine and how they interact politically.
I'm not Maine-born, but I got here when I was 6 months old, so that's, well, probably not lying. I don't know. But anyway, I will say this. Maine voters can smell a phony 10 miles away. They're very good at that. They know who the posers are. And, you know, you can say what you want about the people that we've elected governor over the last 20 years, but all those people were pretty much authentic people. We all knew what they stand for, and they all basically held true to those values throughout their administrations. So that's what I would say. People who are perceived to be perhaps
disingenuous are quickly rejected by Maine voters.
I'm going to end it here. We have more questions, but we've an hour is about what we've decided to have for this. And I want to thank you very much again for coming, and I hope you'll return again when we have another Chamberlain lecture. Maybe we'll have one after the election, and we can talk about all these things that affected whatever the outcome of the election is. And thank you.